Good morning, Your Honor. Please the court. I'm Thomas Griffin. I represent petitioner Nevida Cabeda. As I stated, or as we stated in our letter brief to the court, I think there's plenty of authority for the court at this point to recognize that the board has abandoned the Rodriguez-Rodriguez standard, but even if it hasn't, because the decision was made in this case by it was non-presidential, and they didn't do a full categorical analysis in terms of what sexual abuse of a minor means, that the court is free to craft its own.
How are we free to do that when we have Restrepo on the books?
Sorry.
We have our own precedent. So if you're taking issue with an en banc decision of the BIA, we've already held that that has deference. Is your argument that Esquivel-Quintana, because of the mode of analysis, indicates we should no longer view the statute as ambiguous and therefore not give deference? Or is it that if we got past step one of Chevron, that the BIA's interpretation is unreasonable?
But I think, just to step back, I think in this particular case, under the Chenery Doctrine, regardless of the strength of Restrepo or Rodriguez-Rodriguez before it, the Board of Immigration Appeals decision in my particular case said it doesn't apply, that Rodriguez-Rodriguez doesn't apply. So I guess by implication, they're not looking at the Restrepo type, they're not using that same generic that they had designed.
And they're using you should respond then to the argument that's made by the government that sending it back would be purposeless because it's not going to change what happened, because in fact the BIA came out against you. The rationale that it's not going to change what happened, and in fact it results in no meaningful advancing of the process, because the board, according to the government, this panel had no power to do what it did. It didn't, in fact, legally and properly reject Rodriguez-Rodriguez. It couldn't have done that. Sending it back doesn't change the result, and it doesn't meaningfully move the law forward because they couldn't do properly what they did. I take that to be their argument. What's your response to that when you say Chenery, it's got to go back?
Well, I just think this court's small particular job in Ms. Cabeda's case is to make a ruling on whether or not what the Board of Immigration Appeals said and how it decided was correct.
Right, and they say it wasn't correct, but it was harmless. In other words, it's harmless. It was error, but it was harmless error for the court to say that Esquivel-Quintana controls. So point out the error, but don't send it back because it's purposeless. That's what I'm trying to get you to respond to.
Yeah, I do think that the Esquivel-Quintana case started at the Board of Immigration Appeals before it jumped up to the Ninth Circuit and then to the Supreme Court. And even in Esquivel-Quintana underneath, they were not dealing with Rodriguez-Rodriguez. Then the Ninth Circuit didn't deal, basically overlooked it. They're saying it's not our guidepost. And certainly the Supreme Court said that too. When they were saying, this is how you decide with sexual abuse of minors, here's the methodology. And then you had the government itself picking its own definition, another child abuse definition, and it didn't cite Rodriguez-Rodriguez. But even think at oral argument, the government in Esquivel-Quintana before the Supreme Court also rejected Rodriguez-Rodriguez by moving on to the proper methodology that the board never used to start.
Well,
in Rodriguez-Rodriguez.
Here's the problem with that line of argument that the Attorney General points out, and I'm trying to get you to engage with, mm-hmm. right? From their briefing that the position they're taking is Esquivel-Quintana doesn't change Rodriguez-Rodriguez, didn't purport to change the BIA's reliance on the section 3509A8, and that all it did was focus on one narrow question, and that is age of consent. And on that point, and that point alone, is that precedent controlling. And it, and by its terms, the opinion doesn't seek to undo reliance on 3509A8. So how could it be that it represents a whole sea change and a throwing out of 3509A8 and the Rodriguez-Rodriguez decision when by its terms it says, we're not doing that, we're just focused on this one thing? What's your answer?
I think, for one, I think the BIA's position has been, and I think it's dangerous and it's wrong, is that it's a moving target. And they're saying we use Rodriguez-Rodriguez when it worked because Rodriguez-Rodriguez was about a guy who flashed someone in indecent exposure, and they needed to get that guy deported because that's how they think at the board. So they kept opening it and opening it, opening it, skipping over the criminal statutes, which the Supreme Court says you use the criminal statutes, you follow the regular rules of statutory construction. And Rodriguez-Rodriguez is just, I think, disingenuous the way they said I do think that they're making repairs. They're saying that the Supreme Court has given us guidance and given us a methodology for properly determining what the guidepost should be.
They don't,
and they would use
there's enough. I thought you'd even agreed that Escobar-Quintana does not replace 3509A8 with anything.
Well, there's, Justice Thomas had set out, I think one of the questions, what is sexual abuse of a minor? And then he spends probably about six paragraphs trying to describe what it is. And then he sort of just abandoned it, never finished with a perfect definition besides Merriam-Webster's definition.
Well, he doesn't try to describe the look, here's the challenge here, mm-hmm. right? In the first instance, we want to know from you what the import of Escobar-Quintana is. That's the first thing. And then we can talk about the BIA and Rodriguez-Rodriguez and Restrepo, right? But please, in the first instance, Judge Jordan has told you what he believes the government has argued with regard to the import of Escobar-Quintana. Tell us why that's wrong. Because when you look at the opinion, it's hard to come away from a close reading of the opinion and think that Justice Thomas has done anything more than focused in on the age of the victim. Mm-hmm. And in fact, there are two places in the opinion, which I'm confident you're keenly aware of, that the justice says, we are not coming up with a new definition. And in fact, it's an interesting case because there's a survey of all these states and a chart, you know, and usually we don't have charts in the Supreme Court. So it's clear that there's no definitive, clear to me, I want to know whether it's clear to you, that there's no definitive statement on sexual abuse of minors. So help us, what's the import?
I think the importance of it is that finally the highest court in the country said, here's what you use. Here's how you figure out the generic. But since that's not the case at bar, we're not gonna define it today because we don't need to. But follow these rules, and it set forth the rules. And I think that's the import of it. And I think when you put it, contrast it to the Rodriguez decision's board decision, which was a 9-8 decision with very strong dissents, they didn't follow that methodology. And I think the Supreme Court is sort of a little bit rapprochement to them. They're saying, you know, let's draw the line here. There has to be a guidepost, and when you guys do it, follow these rules. And I think if this court follows the rules, it would never come up with 3509A8 as the definition.
Is that because we would not be getting past Chevron step one? In other words, first, we have to see if the statute clearly addresses the issue on its face, right? And one of the things that Escobar-Quintana seems to do is to take a much more vigorous approach to examining context, other states' statutes, And you know, dictionaries beyond Black's Law Dictionary, to reach the conclusion that the statute itself, when it comes to the question of what does it mean to be a minor, that that term is actually clear on its face, that the plain, it's a plain language conclusion reached in a different way than perhaps we have traditionally thought about step one of the analysis, the Chevron analysis.
I mean, I'm not smart enough to know whether step one is really hit in this case. I mean, it's 1101A43A is murder, rape, and sexual abuse of a minor. In my personal mind, we all know what rape is. We all know what murder is. And I think I know what sexual abuse of a minor is. So, but in terms of how the courts have repeatedly said, like, we don't know. And they didn't define it, and they didn't point us to a particular statute. That's a fine position. And then now Esquivel-Quintana is coming in and saying, here's how you do it.
Well, and, assume that's right, that in fact we get past Chevron step one, which is what I hear you saying we would. We would get to Chevron step one and say ambiguity. If that's true, you know, Restrepo says what it says. We've got a binding decision from an en banc court that says we're gonna accept Rodriguez. We're gonna defer to that. I shouldn't say by en banc. We have a binding precedent from a panel of this court that says we're gonna accept Rodriguez, which was en banc, even if there were dissents. Mm-hmm. And we're going to embrace that. How do we overcome that if all that Esquivel-Quintana said was, hey, when we're looking at age of consent, that's clear. We don't need to go to Chevron deference.
In terms of me saying there were strong dissents, I didn't mean on the Restrepo case. I was referring to the Rodriguez. Just to show the feeble legs that was on, so I'm sorry about that. I don't think that Restrepo stood for the fact that there is a solid guidepost for sexual abuse of a minor that must be 3509A. I think they deferred because there was a reasonable decision underneath, or that was the decision by the court, that it was reasonable. I don't think it was reasonable. That Rodriguez, who had no contact with his victim, that basically was a flasher, should be deported like a murderer and a rapist with no chance of
sure,
staying in
understood,
the United States.
All understood. Here's the, but, let me try to put a finer point on it because we're not getting to where I'm hoping to get, which is to get you to answer this. No, it's my ineptitude question, I'm sure. What can you tell us about Esquivel-Quintana that would say to us this sufficiently undermines the rationale of Restrepo, that you are no longer bound by it? Mm-hmm. We're a panel of the court. We've got a binding precedent on the book. What is it about Quintana Esquivel that would allow us to say, hey, forget that panel decision in Restrepo. Rodriguez doesn't apply. Is it enough to say, well, they talked about a different methodology?
I think they set out the recipe for determining what a generic is. And when you look back at Rodriguez and Restrepo, it wasn't followed. And I think that's the strength of the argument. And I don't think that when an appellate court defers under Chevron deference for a guidepost generic means it's a precedent decision you'll be locked in forever with that.
Does the fact that the age of consent may be perfectly clear mean that everything about sexual abuse of a minor is perfectly clear? In other words, the court in Esquivel-Quintana was able to say, we don't have to worry about Chevron because age of consent, that is clear. We don't have to worry about that. You know, we can talk a lot about, we can survey, et cetera, but respective ages, that's there's nothing mysterious about that. Does that mean that everything about the question of sexual abuse of a minor, as defined in the INA, is clear and unambiguous, and therefore not subject to Chevron?
No, I don't think think that, and I don't. I also don't think they said that the age was obvious, rock solid, you know, throughout the country. That they determined it by using that methodology that they set forth to find sexual abuse of the minor. And when they did it, you know, they did the 50-state survey. They saw there were some states with 18 and some states with maybe 17 and then 16 as the age. And what goes to sort of against what we see in Rodriguez-Rodriguez and in Restrepo is they did the most restrictive one, the one that protects the immigrant the most, sort of maybe some deference to Fung Hao Tan case from the Supreme Court that says doubt should be in favor of, and ambiguities in favor of the immigrant. But they could have said the age of consent is 18 because some of the states included, so we'd scoop up all of them. But instead they restricted down to 16. And what you see is the opposite.
So how does that inform us on sexual abuse of a minor such that we say to ourselves that we must overturn our precedent? Usually when the Supreme Court makes an enunciation that leads a circuit or all of the circuits to re-examine either their holding or the manner in which they came to their holding, it's clear. When you look at Esquivel-Quintana, the manner in which the justice speaks to statutory interpretation, there's nothing unique about it. There's, you know, we look to the dictionary, we look to plain meaning. This age issue is equivocal. So we'll look outside of those two manner or method of making a determination. And he goes through that process. What does that inform us about having to overturn? You want us to overturn our precedent, right? And when that happens, when we're compelled to do that, right, it's usually quite clear from the language and import of the opinion. I don't speak for my colleagues. I don't see it, so I want you to help me get there.
Yeah. I'm sort of taking the position that the precedent decision that Restrepo was and Catapan that followed was too, is not saying that this court from here on out will use as a solid rock guidepost 3509A. It's a precedent in that it defers to that outcome in that case.
So, counsel, it seems like you can get us there two different ways, right? One is the step one way, where Esquivel-Quintana, this Supreme Court, is looking at all sorts of canons of construction, going to look at a 50-state survey, making a determination on language in the statute that does not say 16, doesn't say 18, but they conclude that the term is unambiguous, so they never get to deference, right? They conclude we don't need to consider Chevron deference because the language of the statute unambiguously forecloses the board's interpretation. So that's one argument I mm-hmm. take it you're trying to make, that mm-hmm. we never even get there because Esquivel-Quintana tells us about a methodology that we should follow to determine whether the face of the statute is unambiguous. And Esquivel-Quintana also seems to do something a little different than Restrepo and Rodriguez-Rodriguez, in that instead of looking at the whole term writ large, it focuses in on one particular aspect of it to make an assessment whether that's unambiguous or ambiguous, so that you have to move to the next step. For us, it seems that where there's going to be overbreath, if there is, in the state offense, we're talking about the issue of the penetration with a foreign object where there is not a purpose set forth in the statute, exactly, or there's not a mens rea in the statute. We could take either of those and focus in on that. So addressing that and that, either of those issues, what is your best argument that the we can do the kind of analysis they did in Esquivel-Quintana and conclude that the federal generic as to those issues is unambiguous.
If I don't think the federal generic is unambiguous, that doesn't seem to be the question. I think it's determining what the federal generic is and make sure it's unambiguous. Once the appellate court or the BIA makes a precedent decision that says this is what our guidepost is, that should be unambiguous, because the federal deportation statute, and that's the problem, you know, that leads us to the categorical analysis, is Congress in writing the immigration laws was pretty ambiguous on some of these things.
Well, we need to be able to look at the statute and say we can tell from this statute unambiguously, without having to even get to step two of Chevron, mm-hmm. that the federal generic does have a purpose requirement or has a mens rea requirement that's greater than recklessness.
Your Honor, are you saying that the federal, when you're saying federal generic, are you saying 3509A, or are you saying the term sexual abuse of minor in the immigration statutes?
Sexual abuse of the minor in the immigration statute is just what that we're focused on in trying to ascertain mm-hmm. what the federal generic what the match is in terms of the offense of conviction that would fit within that category.
I think it's repeatedly been said in the decisions before this that there's a definition in the federal law for what sexual abuse is, and that's at 2243. And then this definition is at 2246 that help guide it along. So you've got a criminal statute in the same code that says exactly what sexual abuse of minors. And what started this ball rolling, this snowball, was that Rodriguez was confronted with a guy who flashed someone, and that's not sexual abuse of minor under 2243.
That's unreasonable.
Right? You can't get us like that. It's not speaking for myself. It's not helpful to say in the legal analysis to say, hey, don't trust those BIA guys. They're so result oriented, which is the argument you keep going back mm-hmm. to. Just leave that to the side because mm-hmm. it's not advancing the discussion for mm-hmm. me, at least. What we've got to deal with is, and I think we got to it a minute ago, you really want us to adopt not 3509A8, but what is it, 2240 something. That's the place you want us to go, and of course that's not where we ended up in Restrepo. But so assume for the sake of discussion that we thought we were bound by Restrepo, mm-hmm. and that 3509A8 was the federal generic we had to deal with. That is the federal generic that is our base. You've made arguments that that there's still overbreadth in the Pennsylvania statute, right? And I want you to answer the question, well, two questions. First, why doesn't the word molest, right, molestation in 3509A8 cover everything that the Pennsylvania statute 3101 and in turn 3123A7 cover? Why doesn't the concept of molestation just do enough to cover that ground that the Pennsylvania statutes cover?
That's, to me, a very ambiguous term, and I'm not sure everyone can interpret what molest means. I think it just means to bother.
It means to do something. Yeah, it's very broad.
Yeah.
Indeed. Exactly my point. So why isn't it broad enough to cover any range of things that, of the sort you covered in your briefing? Whether it's ritual, whether it's curiosity, whether it's bizarre things with animals, which you and the government ended up going off to the zoo on, no matter what it is, why doesn't molestation cover that waterfront?
Well, molestation is just, if it just means bother, then everyone's going to go get deported. I mean, I don't know, but if you are getting a piercing or you're having something stuck in one of your orifices, it doesn't necessarily mean that the recipient of it, I guess, is being bothered. He or she may be in on it, and that's
molestation,
all I can think of.
Molestation doesn't mean consent or non-consent. We're dealing with a minor, so technically consent is impossible, right? We're not dealing with consent or being in on it. Mm-hmm. We're dealing with penetration, however slight. And you had come up with some ideas about why, well, that could be stuff that is not covered because Pennsylvania speaks so broadly. And the question I'm putting to you is, how do you get any broader than molestation? It's about as broad as you can get. And why doesn't that cover everything in the Pennsylvania statute?
Because I think you've gotten to the essential problem, is that you had an indecent exposure case that the BIA couldn't find a way, a rational way, I think, to call that sexual abuse. So they find 3509A, and then it scoops it up.
Rodriguez, I'm trying to get you past that. You've made your argument on that, and you've made it effectively, and we understand it. Mm-hmm. Now I'm asking you a different question, which is, take it as given that we are dealing with 3509A8. We're not going back to question the good faith of the BIA and how it got there, and we're accepting for just the sake of discussion that Restrepo controls. And that's our foundation. That's our federal generic.
So we have
that's our federal generic, and we have to do a categorical approach. How do you distinguish the word molestation in a way that doesn't cover everything under 3101?
So, okay, a defendant, an offender, penetrates someone in the genitals or anus in a very slight way. You get arrested and for involuntary deviant sexual intercourse. Was that a molestation? No.
Parlance, wouldn't, if you walked out on the street and said, you're going to penetrate somebody's genital or anus, is that a molestation? Do you think they'd say yes?
If you were getting pierced, if you were getting tattooed, if...
You got to take consent out of it, right? We have to take as a given that consent is not in this because we're dealing with a minor, right? Consent can't be a piece of it.
If molestation just means bothering someone without consent, then I guess so. But I don't think people should be deported and banished for bothering people.
Don't you have to argue to us that there is a difference in the purpose that's read into the federal statute or the mens rea in the federal statute?
Well, what Judge Jordan's saying, if we're holding on to 3509A, there is no purpose. So I don't know what I'm comparing it to. And what we're asking is, you need it.
It's your position that if a babysitter puts a suppository in an infant, that constitutes molestation for purposes of the federal statute. There's no purpose requirement.
It certainly violates the Pennsylvania statute. It's a penetration, however slight, of someone that doesn't have consent, that's for sure. Is it sexual abuse of a minor? No.
Well, here's what I don't understand.
Is it molestation? That's Judge Jordan's question, and I don't know if that baby was molested.
What mandates us to go to 2246 rather than 3509?
If you follow the methodology, the logical methodology that set forth by Esquivel-Quintana in the Supreme Court, you have to go to the closest federal statute. So the first stop to look is the two other terms at 110143A, murder and rape. Those are the most egregious crimes you commit. So you're going to have an egregious or a very high mens rea. That's part one. There's no mens rea in 3509A. The next thing is to look at the criminal statute.
Quintana spends all this time on the least culpable conduct, which is part of the standard analysis. Why are we doing that there?
They're saying there that what's the least culpable conduct someone in the state could do, right? Mm-hmm. And then compare that against the federal generic. So we're just still coming back to what the federal generic is.
Go ahead.
And so, you know, you look at the other terms in 1101 and you got murder and rape. And Esquivel-Quintana says high mens rea. Those are the worst things you could do. The next thing is to look at analogous federal criminal statutes. That's 2243 and the definitions. At the very first level, Rodriguez had someone that there was no contact at all. There was a distance. There was a flashing, nothing more. So they wouldn't use 2243 because the sub-definition of sexual contact required sexual contact. So, like, there was no contact. How are we going to get this guy? At the Restrepo level, there was contact, but it was through clothes. So, and that's another, and at 2243, it doesn't, for the definition of sexual contact, it doesn't include through clothes. Definition kept getting bigger rather than as Esquivel Quintana says, smaller. Get it down to 16 years old, even though some states have 18. Some states have...
Help us understand where you're focusing your argument. Is it that if we do that analysis ourselves, we conclude that the requirement of a purpose in the federal generic is unambiguous, and so that's why Restrepo and Rodriguez are out? Or are you saying ambiguous, okay, but then you turn to look at the deference that we paid in Restrepo, and we only defer to a reasonable interpretation, and your argument is that it's no longer reasonable under the analysis of Esquivel Quintana. Which of those seem like different arguments to me, because they're different stages of the analysis. So which are you arguing?
Well, I think in Restrepo, this court said it's reasonable. We get when you set forth all this language about Congress wanted more people to get deported for more things, the BIA settles on this very expansive thing that has the word molestation in it. You know, all right, if that's your reasoning, then this is reasonable. But I think the fundamental parts of it have to be questioned.
Here's the question I think is being put to you. There's a Chevron Step 1 argument that you could make, and there's a Chevron Step 2 argument that you can make. Mm-hmm. And the question being put to you is, which are you making? Are you making the Step 1 argument, which is, you don't, after Esquivel Quintana, they tell you that if you approach this in a certain way, it's not ambiguous. So you don't have to worry about Rodriguez, and Restrepo, done. That's your step one route. Your step two route is, no, still ambiguous, but we don't have to defer anymore when we get to questioning what this means, because the question now becomes, following Esquivel Quintana, what's the right way to assess ambiguity or whether what the BIA did was reasonable? That's what I take Judge Krause to be putting to you. Mm-hmm. Are you making a step one argument, or are you making a step two argument? Or are you making both? Mm-hmm. You know, so that's put to you, and maybe with that one we'll have exhausted you and everybody else, and we'll move on. But can you answer that question?
Sure. I think the first thing we look at is 1101.43a1, sexual abuse. Is that an ambiguous term? I will concede that it's an ambiguous term. Different people can interpret it different ways. So we move to step two. What are the tools, the traditional tools of statutory analysis, statutory interpretation? And Justice Thomas set it out and hammered it home. And the very first thing he used was the Merriam-Webster Dictionary, the popular, ordinary people definition. And it has sexual contact with someone who doesn't give consent.
So
and that's sexual abuse.
Bottom line is that's, you're not making a step one argument. You're making a step two argument, and your step two argument is Rodriguez, you don't have to defer to that anymore because Esquivel Quintana tells you that that's not a reasonable interpretation. But Esquivel Quintana will tell you how to get to a reasonable interpretation.
Exactly.
Okay.
Yeah.
Anything else? Mm-hmm. Oh, okay. Thank you very much, Mr. Griffin. We'll hear from the government.
May it please this court, my name is Andrew Olivero on behalf of the respondent, the Attorney General of the United States. The Supreme Court's decision in Esquivel Quintana did not repudiate Rodriguez, or this court's decision in Restrepo.
But the BIA did, right? Or at least this panel of the board did.
It's not clear what the board did.
How can you say that when they said in hoc verba, we agree that Rodriguez, we agree that Esquivel-Quintana controls and that it was a mistake for the IJ to look to Rodriguez. They, I'm not quoting exactly, I could find the quote for you, but that is what the board said here, didn't it?
Yes, in a very...
But what's unclear about that?
Well, there was
no... You'd be wrong, but what's unclear about it?
Well, they didn't explain why they were departing from their precedent and...
Okay, it may be wrong, but they were clear, weren't they?
They were certainly wrong, and honestly, Your Honor, I don't quite understand how they got where they got, because a reading of Esquivel-Quintana does not produce a new definition of sexual abuse of a minor.
So we accept for the sake of discussion that they clearly did reject Rodriguez, and they clearly did say Esquivel-Quintana now controls. Does that have any legal import at all in how we should be approaching this case?
No. As we stated both in our brief and in the letter memorandum, the board's decision here was unpublished, so therefore cannot reverse Rodriguez. Furthermore, it lacked sufficient analysis to reverse Rodriguez. And
does that mean that we should just, like, end of subject, send the thing back without further discussion, say, hey, you did this wrong and you can't do this, now do it right? What allows us, or what would permit us, or why should we get into an extended discussion of what the right thing to do is when the board didn't do the right thing and everybody acknowledges everybody doesn't like something that the board did here, right? They don't like the board's result.
One way or the other.
Ms. Cabetta, you don't like the board's approach. Why shouldn't we just send it back and say, hey, you got this wrong, you better do it right?
Remand would be an option. But we do note, though, that there is, you know, precedent of this court and others that say that, you know, the remand, it's not a game of ping pong. This court knows what the definition of sexual abuse of a minor based on its controlling precedent. The board in this case did not follow its precedent, so remand would be for the purpose of following its precedent, which would be reaching the exact same result that it reached before.
And we'd end up here again.
Yes.
What if we concluded that Rodriguez no longer reflected a reasonable interpretation of sexual abuse of a minor?
Well, with that respect, I would say that the Second Circuit in Acevedo, which we cited in the letter brief, which came down after briefing, addresses that very question and says that Rodriguez remains an appropriate interpretation of a ambiguous term.
Well, each circuit's going to address this issue as it comes up, right?
Correct.
So we've got a couple that have said doesn't change a whole lot, although Acevedo did seem to move on when it came to the mens rea question and said we're not going to give for deference to 3509 here or the board's interpretation. We're going to conclude that there's nothing in 3509 on mens rea, and so we got to figure that out.
That is correct. That is what they did, Your Honor.
So should we take that approach here and look at mens rea to say we got a clear-cut disparity here? The government concedes that recklessness applies in the state, mm-hmm. and if we're going to look at every indication of what minimum mens rea is required for a federal generic offense of sexual abuse of a minor, it seems to be at least knowing, right?
Well, as the Second Circuit said with that specific statute, that there was no way of committing the offense, which is very similar to the statute at question here. But there was no way you could do it. It at a minimum, it had to be knowing.
Is that appropriate to do if you're looking at whether there is in fact elements that match? I mean, once we conclude that the elements simply don't match, that there's a different mens rea that's required, is it really appropriate to say, well, we're going to go ahead and try to interpret the statute here to then use legal imagination and see if there's any circumstance that would allow us to differentiate?
With respect to the judicial imagination, that's the point, is that you have to look at the realistic probability, and that's what the Second Circuit did.
But why do we do that if we conclude that there is not even a match between the elements?
But the point of 3509 is that it is an inclusive definition, and so that it's not... It covers the broad range of conduct, and the mens rea admittedly is not addressed in 3509-8. But the Pennsylvania statute does have the three, intentionally, knowingly, or reckless. So at a minimum, it's reckless. Petitioner has not presented any arguments why recklessness would not cover. But if this court disagrees, then Acevedo provides an alternative analysis.
So do we then need to look at the way the Pennsylvania statute is written and the exceptions that it provides to ascertain whether one could recklessly violate that statute?
Yes, you would refer to the statute.
I'm puzzled when you say Acevedo provides an alternative. Maybe I misunderstand Acevedo, but it seems like you just backed into a corner, because the Second Circuit goes out of its way to make this mens rea point and then says, hey, it's got to be pretty serious stuff because it's in there next to murder, rape, sexual abuse of a minor, and therefore... we have to keep that in mind when deciding what the mens rea is. If you're saying to yourself, boy, this has to be really bad, really egregious, serious, serious stuff, how do you get to reckless, the least culpable mindset for criminal behavior?
Well,
the New York statute, it might have worked for the New York statute that they were looking at, but we're not looking at the New York statute. We're looking at the Pennsylvania statute, where recklessness is the lowest mens rea.
Correct. And what the Second Circuit said, though, was that looking at the New York statute, the minimum mens rea that you could actually, to do the conduct, it had to be at a minimum knowingly. And if you apply that analysis to the statute here, again, it can only be, following the Second Circuit, it would be the same.
But that it's knowing the same as reckless?
No.
Okay.
What the Second Circuit said is that there was no way of committing the New York statute recklessly.
Right. Exactly my point. If the Pennsylvania statute says you can commit an offense here recklessly, and Acevedo was pegging it at knowing, isn't that a problem for the government?
No, Your Honor, because the Second Circuit didn't look at New York's culpability. They relied on Duenas to look at whether you could commit realistically the conduct in the New York statute. They weren't looking at New York's culpability statute. They were looking at just the criminal statute. So in this case, it would be the 23A7.
Yeah.
And said that realistically, you could only commit that crime knowingly or intentionally.
Yeah. So what's your Acevedo argument here? Is your Acevedo argument here that there's no way to commit the Pennsylvania crime in any way that's other than knowingly?
Or intentionally, correct.
Well, that's a strange thing in light of the assertion that in the statute that, hey, you can violate this recklessly. Unless what you're saying is, don't worry, they'll never prosecute for reckless behavior.
That is...
Well, that's an odd thing to say when the statute says you can be prosecuted for reckless behavior.
But when it comes to the statute in question, the statutory rape of a minor, as the Second Circuit pointed out, that you cannot commit that recklessly.
Well, here's the, I guess I'm having a little bit of difficulty because I'm not sure how we got to statutory rape of a minor. I thought we were at a categorical comparison between 3509A8 and Pennsylvania Consolidated Statute Section 3101. And we were asking ourselves whether there was a categorical match. Not whether what she actually did was a crime that you could commit only knowingly, but whether generically 3509A8 of Title 18, excuse me, I think it's, is it 18? Yeah. The U.S. Code matches up with Section 3101. Isn't that the question in front of us?
No, the question is whether her conviction under A7 is a categorical match to 3509A8.
3123A7.
Yes.
3123A7.
Yes.
So,
which is,
so we can look to what she did. It's not a categorical.
No, it is categorical, but the issue is that the definition of deviant sexual intercourse is in, so you have to read that definition in conjunction with subsection A7. She committed deviant sexual intercourse with a minor under the age of 16.
The only thing that 3123A7 adds is the age of consent, right? Well, and that we're talking about deviant sexual intercourse.
Yeah,
right?
Deviant sexual intercourse with a minor under the age of 16.
Right, but 3101, which
defines deviant
before,
sexual intercourse,
defines
yes.
deviant sexual intercourse. So the only thing that 3123A7 adds is the minor piece, right? That you're a felony if you do this with somebody under the age of 16. Am I wrong about that?
That is correct.
Okay.
And that has a mens rea of recklessness.
There's the general provision that yes.
How do you get to the knowing part? Maybe I'm just like trapped. Maybe I'm not understanding you, but I understand you'd be saying Acevedo tells you that this can only be done knowingly, and that doesn't help us if what we're looking at is a statute that says in Pennsylvania you can do that recklessly, and we will prosecute you for it because we put it right in our code.
Well, the issue with Acevedo, and again, I would note that it came down, so we didn't have time to fully brief it, but the issue there wasn't whether New York said you could commit the statute recklessly. It's whether they had a general provision like Pennsylvania. It's whether the conduct in question, so committing deviant sexual intercourse with a minor under the age of 16, could you do that recklessly?
Could it ever be done? No matter what the state says in their code, could you ever engage in penetration, however slight,
with a victim under the age of 16 engaging in deviant sexual,
you ever do that recklessly? And you're saying Acevedo tells you that could never happen recklessly.
Under the realistic probability test, that is correct.
We're dealing with fundamentally different statutes, though, right? I mean, in New York, they were looking at being 18 years old or more, engages in oral sexual conduct or anal sexual conduct with another person less than 15 years old. With that not having a mens rea, the Second Circuit went and read one into it saying those two activities, oral sexual conduct or anal sexual conduct, could only be committed knowingly. We're dealing with a statute that is written very differently.
Well, right? It
includes penetration, however slight, with a foreign object, and it's for any purpose with some carve-outs.
And, well, again, I don't see how that can be done recklessly. And even if you do go with a reckless mens rea, there's just, even if you're recklessly inserting something into the genitals of a child, that falls within the definition of sexual abuse of a minor. There's no reason not to, at a minimum, do reckless conduct.
Well, in the end, you're falling back on the assertion, I take it, that there's no realistic possibility that the state of Pennsylvania would ever prosecute somebody for deviant sexual intercourse with a minor unless there was knowing behavior. Is that it?
Yes. And again, the
so that's just inartfully drafted statutory language to say you could do it recklessly, because the statute says you could do it recklessly, but you're saying that'll never happen.
That is that's what the Second Circuit concluded.
Well, they concluded about a New York statute, not about this one. That's why I don't want to keep going around in this circle, but you seem to be leaning heavily on Acevedo to say you can get sort of a don't worry about that mens rea thing and pointing us to Acevedo. But just the way you look at Cabeda and tell us, hey, you did this with a much less significant crime in Cabeda, so don't worry about it here. It was a different statute. I mean, that's the problem I'm having with the government's argument. It seems to sort of have a kind of a seriousness aspect to it, as if we were looking at these crimes and saying, well, that's really bad, and this is really bad, so it must be covered. But the categorical approach doesn't ask us what's bad and isn't bad. Categorical approach takes us into the bizarro world and asks us, is there a match? And that's all it asks. It doesn't make distinctions about badness. It just says, is on a Venn diagram, is this circle all the way within that circle, or is this circle sort of somewhat in that and somewhat outside it? Because if it's not all the way inside it, it's not categorically a match. Badness be darned. Doesn't matter, right?
Correct. And I apologize if I led you off, but the 35098 and the Pennsylvania statute of question are a categorical match.
That's the question that we put to Mr. Griffin. How do you get to the categorical match?
Right.
How's the overlap? How is it complete?
And not to flog a dead horse, but using the realistic probability test. So doing it within the realm of conduct that Pennsylvania actually would prosecute, and not imagine scenarios involving police torture or whatnot. Under the realistic probability test, what you have is a statute where a child is being, at a minimum, penetrated in their sexual organs. That falls within 3509A8's definition of sexual abuse of a minor, at a minimum, molestation or other forms of sexual exploitation.
How about things like genital piercing, or the suppository example I gave before?
Well, the suppository, I believe, would fall under the medical or hygienic exception.
A babysitter inserting a suppository is a medical procedure?
It would be giving medicine.
It's a procedure.
Yes, I mean, it's or it's a hygienic. There's a very limited exceptions. And the imagination required to go beyond 3508 just is not realistic.
But isn't that the problem, that they are limited exceptions? And by their terms, they seem pretty formal. It's not like Alaska statute is, you know, any activity that would be associated with a caregiver. A very broad exception that would seem to take out most things you could think of. But if we have a carve-out for something as specific as medical or hygienic procedures or law enforcement procedures, doesn't that leave a whole lot out there that could be done recklessly?
Perhaps, but as we noted, though, that there are no arguments presented why reckless behavior would not be covered. Because, again, Cabeda really focused on...
Are you saying the federal generic includes recklessness?
It covers the Pennsylvania statute in question here, yes.
So you think that 3509 has... However, using that as a guide, coming up with the mens rea for the federal generic offense would be something less than a knowing offense, notwithstanding all of the other provisions that talk about what sexual abuse or sexual abuse of a minor mean in the U.S. Code.
Well, but the key import, though, is that you're not directly importing federal statutory law. It's you're doing a broad survey, including the dictionary definition, how states do it, which is what the board did in Rodriguez. It didn't pick 3509A8 randomly. It considered 22, 42, 43, and 46 as the operative definition and rejected them because they were too narrow.
Where do you get reckless in 3509?
I mean, there is no mens rea in 3509A8.
So if we need to ascertain what the federal generic mens rea is, how do we do that?
Well, at this time, the board has not provided an answer. The Second Circuit provided an answer in Acevedo.
But if we accept that it's got to be at least knowing, like the Second Circuit, they were able to conclude that the state statute in question had knowing, but we have a different statute.
Yes.
So if we were to follow their approach, you would agree that we have two different mens reas in front of us, the federal one of knowing and the state of reckless.
And the Second Circuit, though, explained, though, that the conduct in question and the conduct here could not be done at a minimum.
We're back to your assertion that it's an inartfully drafted statute. Even though it says it covers reckless behavior, it's impossible to actually imagine that the state would prosecute reckless behavior, and therefore consistent with what footnote 3 on page 20 of your brief, it's unrealistic, don't worry about it. That's what we're coming back to again, right?
We have not been able to find any examples of a reckless conviction.
Right. So that's the assertion, is inartfully drafted statute, they'd never prosecute it. I mean, if you don't go there, you've got no place to go, do you? Because
correct.
There's a recklessness in the statute, and there's a knowing provision, which is the only thing you've been able to point us to, and that's Acevedo. Two different ones. And the only way you get to categorical match is to say, don't worry about that recklessness stuff in the statute. They'd never do it. Pennsylvania would never do it. Am I right?
That is correct.
Okay. Good. Anything else?
No, good.
Okay.
If there are no other further questions, we would ask that you affirm the result of the board and in the alternative remand for further consideration.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you
very much. Mr. Oliveira, Mr. Griffin.
Just quickly.
I know there was some discussion on realistic probability. I think this court has abandoned realistic probability. And if it's in the statute and if the Pennsylvania legislator wrote it in, that's it, no matter how strange or bizarre it could be. The latest case, I think, was Salmeron, which I cited in my opening brief, saying realistic probability test is not in play.
We've got Duenas-Alvarez, Supreme Court precedent, which tells us that realistic probability is an issue, that you shouldn't just be imagining stuff happening. So why isn't that a live argument for the government to make, to say they're not going to prosecute somebody for this kind of molestation if what they're really saying is a person stumbled into him in the hallway and recklessly mm-hmm. penetrated their genitalia. That's just never going to get prosecuted, mm-hmm. period. It's only going to get prosecuted if you've got bad behavior, knowing behavior.
I understand that. I just think that if it's possible to have it happen in the statute, any of the examples I've given in Judge Krause's suppository example are not bizarro examples at all.
The suppository example, we go back and forth on that, but mm-hmm. the government's at least got a response to that, which is inserting a suppository medicine into somebody's anus is a medical procedure. It may not involve mm-hmm. forceps mm-hmm. and a scalpel, but you're engaged in, quote, good faith medical work, one would say, or if the babysitter was just doing it because they were wacko and got some sick pleasure out of it, then you would no longer be in good faith and you might be prosecuted. But the point of saying good faith medical is to say you can put a thermometer in a child's anus, or you can put a suppository in there, in good faith, and you're not going to be criminally liable because that's a medical procedure that everybody recognizes you take care of mm-hmm. with an infant. So they've got an answer to that. What else do you have which would be sort of reckless that you could imagine, oh, yeah, they'd go after you for that?
Well, I mean, I think the examples I've already set forth are there. I could definitely see parents coming home where there was a suppository inserted in their child by the babysitter, and they're after the babysitter for some reason, and they will
We'll have an argument about good faith there, but not recklessness. The babysitter's not going to say, I had this suppository in my hand, and the baby was right there, and I tripped, and that's not going to happen, right? It's going to be an argument about whether that was a good faith action by the babysitter, right?
Yes, I understand, Your Honor.
Yeah.
I think just another quick point, I think under Brand X, sort of the back and forth between the board is okay. This court's not locked into 3509A because the board used it once, and this court agreed with it once. I think the mens rea question that Judge Krause got into, there's two mens rea, and this panel hasn't talked about the other one, but Judge Krause was talking about knowing and reckless. But if you see this, that the where I set forth six or seven of your sister courts, the mens rea that they talk about is for sexual or libidinal gratification. So that sort of that ending prepositional phrase is what those courts say are the mens rea. They just don't get into knowing, reckless, and negligent. So, and that's missing from 3509A. So that's what takes the sex part out of it. And if you look at the second sentence in the Pennsylvania criminal statute that Ms. Cabeda pleaded guilty to, there's nothing sexual on that penetration sentence. So, and all the sister courts here, or the seven here that I cited, all say it has to be for libidinal or sexual gratification of a person. And then because I think the board did such a bad job and at the same time said repudiated at least this three-member panel of the board, Rodriguez, this court is free to design its own definition, and I would recommend 2243. And the problem the Restrepo court had here was their contact wasn't through, it didn't allow for contact through the clothing. But you can just go to one subsection down to 2246, where it says sexual contact, including direct or through the clothing. So an easy and very precise sexual abuse definition can be found in the federal statutes.
All right, thank you, Mr. Griffin.
Thank you.
Mr. Olivero, we've got the case under advisement. I will recess the court.
Court stands adjourned until Wednesday, January 15 at 9:30 a.m.